It painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. To learn more about upskilling or reskilling for a current job or career, information is online at shastacollege.edu or call one of our counselors to see how easy it is to get enrolled at 530-242-7650. Shasta College offers in-person, hybrid, and online class options to fit your busy life and responsibilities. Financial aid is available. More at shastacollege.edu.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The idea here basically amounts to dissolving the boundaries of ourselves, that we're too limited. We're too weak, we're too slow, we're basically just primitive machines, and we need an update.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Spencer Klavan. He's the author of the brand new book, How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for 5 Modern Crises. We'll talk in depth with Spencer about the book and those crises a little bit later on in today's program. First, we're joined by John J. Miller. He is director of the Dial Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
Talking with you today about media literacy requirements for high schoolers or even for grade schoolers, depending on the state that you're looking at. Illinois has a requirement in place by law. New Jersey is at least considering, if not moving forward with one. I guess first, I want to ask how you would define media literacy. Reading these stories, it sounds like proponents mean something like knowing who is behind the information being shared. Generally speaking, our teenagers today, our grade schoolers, teenagers, high schoolers, lacking in that kind of skill? Is it a problem that you see that needs to be addressed?
Well, I suppose we're all lacking in that kind of skill. The world of media today is so enormous and diverse and confusing that it's difficult for anybody to understand always what you can trust and not trust. So it's probably especially confusing for young people, but I think it's confusing for everyone, maybe in different ways, but confusing for us all.
If we're trying to address this at a younger age, who theoretically should be responsible for it? Parents, educators, is it a good idea to assign this topic to our schools?
I don't know that our schools are a great place for this. You know, media literacy is a good thing. We all should have it. We should all have financial literacy. We should all know how to change a flat tire on our cars. There are lots of things we should know. They don't all necessarily belong in schools. Schools have enough trouble with basic literacy. You know, reading and writing. Why would we burden them with more? So when you think about what are the core things a school should do, I think media literacy's got to be pretty far down on that list. It's a good thing, we should all know it, but I think this falls onto parents, it falls onto consumers of news themselves to think hard about these sorts of questions and learn on their own. Let experience become a kind of teacher. I'm skeptical about the idea that schools, number one, should be doing it at all, because they probably wouldn't do it well. And then number two, whose responsibility is it really anyway? They have enough trouble with the things we really count on them to do.
You mentioned a bit ago, it's not just grade schoolers or high schoolers, but many of us, perhaps nearly all of us, who have some media literacy gaps. Do you have suggestions for ways in which people should consume the news and understand the news?
Number one is be deliberate about how you consume the news. A lot of people are not deliberate about it. They just take the news as it comes to them. They take it as their Twitter feed throws it at them as their different social media sites present it to them. And that's really not the best way. That's just people hurling stuff at you, and you don't know where it's coming from. Sometimes who even are these people doing it? My number one recommendation is go to trusted news sites and read the news there. News sites that you think are good, that have a good track record. I go to several newspapers every day and read them, and they are of varying quality, but I read them all because I trust them in different ways and I count on them in different ways. And I think we can all find those sorts of news sources, whether you just want general news and information about our country and the world, whether you want to know what's happening in the stock market, in the world of sports. There are all great places we can go, but be deliberate. Go seek it out rather than let it just come at you randomly.
And this idea of multiple sources, reading about a particular item or a particular story from different angles or from different writers, gives the reader at least different angles on what they're trying to understand.
That's a great way to go about it. If you're interested in a particular topic, don't just read one article or one editorial or one columnist. Go see what are other people saying. And you can sometimes learn the most about a topic by reading a source with which you have some disagreement. Sometimes if there's a contentious issue and you really want to learn about it, go read the best argument that the other side can put forward. They may not convince you. They may raise your you may learn something from them. You may learn a new point. You may learn how to better make your own case. At any rate, go seek out some different sources and learn what you can. Now, we are all limited in our time, and we can't read 10 articles about everything. And I think fundamentally you want to be able to go to one place and read about, you know, yesterday's missile test in North Korea. You don't need to go read 5 articles on that. You want trusted news sources, but you got to go find them. You got to go and to places that are reliable and read articles there.
Talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, about media literacy requirements for school children. As part of this training, at least in Illinois, students apparently are encouraged to go to Wikipedia to check out sources and what's behind the sources and maybe who's funding sources. Is that problematic? Who's watching Wikipedia?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, first of all, Wikipedia is awesome. I love Wikipedia. It's one of the best things about the internet is the ability to go to Wikipedia and discover, you know, what year was Abraham Lincoln born or what have you. For basic facts and information, for pop culture, for all kinds of things, Wikipedia is a remarkable source. We all do use it. We should use it. It's fundamentally reliable. Having said that, you never cite it. You never cite it here at the college. You never cite it in your academic research papers. I would never cite it as a journalist. And that's because of how it's produced. It's a collective thing. It's crowdsourced are the terms we might use. We don't really ever know who the exact author of it is. You know, it's kind of branded as Wikipedia. But right now someone can go in and insert a lie or something that's just wrong or a misinterpretation. And it can happen right now. I'm actually an editor at Wikipedia, which means I can go and change the entries. And I'm not a, you know, I don't write big long entries and I'm not real active, but sometimes I'll fix grammar or I'll correct a minor point that I think is off. Anybody can go in and do it, and so you've got to be really careful. You can use this information. You often want to double check it, but for, you know, basic questions, it's pretty reliable. But it does also have a liberal bias. That's clear, especially if you're dealing with contemporary events.
Does this kind of intrusion by the government via mandate through the schools into the world of journalism lead to some concerns for you?
Well, it definitely complicates things. It's for schools and for teachers, it's yet another requirement that they don't need. They have a hard enough time doing the job they're given, the tremendously important job they're giving of educating children. They don't need yet another requirement. And I can imagine in a particular teacher who's really motivated on this subject and maybe gifted about talking about media literacy, go ahead and do it if you think it's important and can do it well. But for most teachers, this is going to be just another kind of burden. You're using somebody else's notes. You'd rather be doing a different thing that's more important and compelling for the kids. They hardly need this. So my advice is let the schools do what they're supposed to do well. Basic literacy, real literacy of reading and writing, adding and subtracting, learning about history, learning about civics, learning about science. Let them do these things, and the rest can come in other ways.
John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College. John, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks, Scott.
Up next, we're joined by Spencer Klavan. His brand new book is How to Save the West. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice. Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Hi, Bob the Drop here. The other day, I had a close encounter with my friends from Mars. I visited them a few years back, and they discovered the great taste of Mount Shasta spring water. Well, I guess they ran out, so they came back to Earth to get some more. I reminded them it comes from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta, and it's bottled at the source. I guess they just didn't get the part about us delivering right to your door. Have your own close encounter by calling 1-800-922-6227 to get some of the best tasting water in the galaxy. Pure and simple, naturally, the best. Mount Shasta spring water.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out our Twitter feed for updated schedules and guest information. We're at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined now by Spencer Klavan, a scholar, writer, and podcaster. He's now an editor at the Claremont Institute and writes for many outlets. His new book is available now. It is How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Let's define something first. What is the West, and why is it in need of someone or someones to step in and save it? We'll get to the specific reasons in a bit, those five crises, but why does someone need to step in and do something?
Sure enough. You know, when I told a friend that I was working on a book called How to Save the West, she responded, oh, that's great. I love John Wayne movies. And I said, not that West. but I actually think that it speaks to a bit of a deeper problem, because when you say that you're in defense of Western civilization or you believe in Western civilization, you get called all kinds of nasty names, I've discovered. You get called a racist, or you're just primitive. You're looking back to, you know, those dead old white guys. And what I mean when I say the West is actually not a geographical region or even one country, what I mean is the cultural and intellectual inheritance of Athens and Jerusalem, these two great pillars of our civilization. Athens stands in for the philosophies and the pagan insights of the Greco-Roman world, and Jerusalem stands in for the faith tradition of Jerusalem, of Israel and the Jewish people and the Christians who in many ways took up that mantle and carried it into Europe and ended up converting the Roman Empire, which in a certain sense builds our world. This is the world we're still living in. And, you know, why does it need saving? Well, on one level, of course, you know, we live in a fallen world. We're always going to be up against problems. But I think at the moment we are particularly facing down a crisis that has been precipitated by our digital revolution, that with all the new technology we have, you know, found just kind of invading our lives, we're suddenly faced with these very basic questions about who we are, what our place is in the universe, how we can know and seek the truth. And what's funny about that is it makes us feel as if we're all alone in this brave new world, and there's, you know, there's nothing that we can do to understand or make sense of it. But in fact, the point of this book is that many of these fundamental questions have been around for as long as humans have been around. And the wisdom of the past is actually our best tool for looking ahead into the future. So that's the idea of the book.
Spencer, these five modern crises, I want to spend at least a minute or two on each of them. I had mentioned to you off the air, we could spend 15, 20 minutes on each of these chapters. They're so in-depth and interesting. The first crisis you discuss in the book is the reality crisis. Now, I think if you asked people, what's the big crisis in the West today? What do we need to fix? How do we need to address this? I don't know if reality or what you address here would be the number one choice. Why do you lead the book with the reality crisis?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you're definitely right. You know, I think we use this word crisis kind of flippantly and freely these days, in part to express our sense that so much is going wrong. You know, we have a crisis in housing. We have a crisis in the supply chain. These are the things that people think of when they think about crises. And many of those are very serious problems, and I don't mean to downplay them. But the Greek word krisis, as I describe and explain in the book, is a word for a conflict between two mutually unreconcilable ways of looking at the world and understanding ourselves. And once you grasp that there are sort of these deeper questions at stake in a lot of the fights we have during the news cycle and, you know, in the daily news, you start to realize that our real crises actually go much, much deeper than just the momentary stories that sort of flit across our news feeds.
You mentioned a little earlier this digital revolution has really changed and affected a number of these crises. But people who are engaged heavily in this digital revolution seem more miserable the more online they are. Why is there still a thought that people will be happier, their lives will be more fulfilling if they are more virtual and more online?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I identify in the book, I think, a pattern of thought that, you know, it predates the digital revolution. There's always been this temptation, and in some cases it's a cynical or knowing temptation to make the offer to people, you know, what we're doing now is making everybody miserable. This communist revolution, let's say, is making everybody miserable, or this, you know, sophistic turn in a new thought. But if we just take it to the max, if we just drive it to its infinite extreme, then we will be in utopia. Utopia is just over the horizon of pain and despair. And I think that's a very, you know, it's easy to want that to be true. It's also easy and natural to want an escape from the real world, from our, you know, from our bodies, which die, and from the fallenness and brokenness that we face in the world. But the truth of the matter is that those offers don't pay off. What people need to recover, I think, is a sense of ownership and trust in their natural intuitions that something's not right about this.
The next crisis you tackle in the book, Spencer Clave, in the book How to Save the West, is a crisis of the body and the spirit and flesh section of this body crisis. You delineate between technology that restores or supports life and technology that attempts to transcend life. What are the consequences if we continue or we go down this path of attempting to redefine what happiness means and redefine what humanity is?
It's a great question, and I think it's one that, you know, it can be kind of chilling to contemplate, because of course the offer or the idea that's kind of on the table right now with the, you know, extreme uptick in transgender operations and ideology, and also with these propositions that relate to transhumanism, which is this idea that we're going to move beyond our bodies altogether or just enhance them so far that they're unrecognizable. The idea here basically amounts to dissolving the boundaries of ourselves, that we're too limited, we're too weak, we're too slow, we're basically just primitive machines and we need an update. But what I show in the book is that this is itself a very old idea. It goes back at least to the Neoplatonists. And what it actually leads to is the total dissolution of the human self. If you don't have a body, if you're not something more than mere flesh, but rather a soul that is expressed in a body, if that's not true, then there's really no basis for wanting or pursuing anything, and pleasure and joy and even things that, you know, we care about very deeply lose all of their meaning. So this is really, I think, the reason why these things never quite work out the way they seem to, is because what we actually are, as Aristotle argued and as Thomas Aquinas pointed out and sort of, you know, reinforced, what we actually are is embodied souls. This is the Greek concept that we call hylomorphism, the mixture of form in matter. And I think that recovering that sense that our bodies aren't an accident, they're not an encumbrance or an appendage or a toy, they're actually threaded through with life, form, meaning, and the soul. That's a more ennobling way and a saner way to proceed with these questions.
Spencer Clavin is with us. His brand new book, How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. We'll talk more with Spencer in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The seasons are changing. Keeping your family healthy is important. So is the health of your car. The longevity and reliability of your vehicle depends on you to make sure your oil, radiator coolant, windshield wipers, and other vital systems have all been taken care of so your car can bring your healthy family through the seasons. Drive into Premier Oil Change today and experience the friendly oil change. Premier doesn't require an appointment, and you don't drop your car off or wait. Maintain your car warranty with our service while you stay in the comfort and safety of your own own car. Enjoy a free beverage and Wi-Fi while our trained technicians perform our comprehensive 30-point service. Earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Stop into a Premier Oil Change near you today. Visit us in Palisadro, in the Holiday Shopping Center, or in Redding, on Lake Boulevard, near Waterworks Park, and Anderson, across from Roundtable Pizza. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Premier, your friendly oil change. Premier, your friendly oil change.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Do you or someone you love struggle with PTSD, anxiety, depression, insomnia, OCD, alcoholism, substance abuse disorder, autism, ADHD, brain fog, or traumatic brain injury? At Shasta Meadows Wellness Center, Dr. Tiger and his team offer safe, proven, and effective care, even for those resistant to typical medicine. Learn more about Shasta Meadows Wellness Center. They have IV ketamine or at-home oral ketamine. Ask about the state-of-the-art EEG-guided TMS therapy. This customized, safe, no-side-effect option is effective on a wide range of difficult-to-treat conditions. Visit us today at ShastaMeadowsWellness.com. Don't just get by. Get well.
Call to make an appointment for a free consultation. 530-444-8304. 530-444-8304. Shasta Meadows Wellness Center in Redding.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
Hey, what's going on, Redding, California? This is Tony Horde with Better Homes and Gardens Results Real Estate. Be sure and tune in to KCNR on your radio dial Wednesdays at 5 p.m. for Living in the North State. Together with my three amazing co-hosts, Rich Howe, Bill Woodford, and Mindy Cochran, we'll be interviewing professionals in the industry and taking your calls to answer all your questions and have a great time doing so. Talk to you then, Redding.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Spencer Klavan. His brand new book is How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises.
The third crisis, I was most intrigued by this chapter of the book, though again, as I mentioned, they are all deeply interesting. The crisis of meaning, and you talk about art, this deep disagreement that is beginning to show about what art is for, and what moral responsibilities artists have. Both sides seem to agree, Spencer, and realize the significant political power of art. We talk a lot here at Hillsdale about helping the moral imagination bloom in children. And what does that? It's art. It's great literature that does that. You say conservatives should focus on not what is depicted in some of this art, but how it is depicted. What does that look like in practice?
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear you talk about the moral dimensions of art, but also the joy and the beauty of enriching the moral imagination through art. Conservatives for a long time have rightly criticized modern art and modern culture for its kind of emptiness and its, in many cases, just moral offensiveness, that it shows, you know, purposefully ugly activity, that it's hypersexualized. And all of these things are true. I mean, you just have to watch the Grammys this year to, mm-hmm. know that, this is the case.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I don't think we've been so good at realizing yet is that, you know, a lot of the literature we love and cherish also contains violence, sex, I mean, all of these things that we get incensed about. And what that reveals, if we ask ourselves, well, why do we love and celebrate Shakespeare, who depicts, for instance, in Macbeth, the grim descent into nihilism that ensues after a murder, right? I mean, why do we love and celebrate that, but not these, you know, violent rap songs, let's say, that seem sort of more pernicious to us? And the answer that I give is, you know, art is a means of communicating truth that can't be communicated any other way, because they don't live in kind of scientific, factual propositions, but they live in the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
And the truths of the human heart require metaphor, they require story in order to be fully expressed. And so what we're seeing when we see, you know, something like Cardi B or, you know, Sam Smith dancing at the Grammys, we're not just seeing somebody that's putting, you know, sexual content on stage. What we're seeing is a lie. We're seeing the world portrayed as if morality was simply not a dimension that mattered for humans, as if it was consequence-free to do all of these sort of ugly and degrading things.
Spencer Clavin, the modern crisis of religion. You say the more confident we become in the pure objectivity of science and its total claim to explain everything, the more mystical, indeed theological, science becomes. So why have scientists taken a place for many in our society that is akin to priests or philosophers?
You know, the Bible in the Psalms has this claim that the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And I think sometimes we read that line and we just take it to mean that it's kind of dumb to be an atheist, that it's stupid to not believe in God. But actually, I think the line has a much deeper meaning than that. What the Bible shows again and again, constantly, in Hebrew scripture especially, you get this insistence that if you think that you don't worship something, that's what makes you a fool. A fool who says in his heart there is no God is the fool who tells himself that there is no higher good that he ascribes to, that he worships before or bows down to. And actually, we all have a God. We all have an idol, if that's what it is, something that drives our activities, that leads us toward what we think is the good. And if we think that's not true, then we're deceiving ourselves, and what we'll end up doing is becoming blind worshipers of idols. And that's what you're seeing in our relationship to science. It's not that science itself has changed into something evil and pernicious, it's that we've put science in the place of the highest good and the absolute truth. So when Dr. Fauci comes out and he says, I represent the science, that's not a man who's actually doing science, that's a man who's presenting himself as a clerical authority, as a priest.
Toward the end of this religion chapter, Spencer, you spent some time talking about how religion is, the modern people say religion is for the rubes, or the low intelligence, but at the end you say, in your actions, if not your words, you already believe in something rather than nothing. Charles Murray has this line that the problem with liberals is that they don't preach what they actually practice. Can we also apply that here? Why are people so hesitant to say what they believe other than perhaps saying, oh, I'm spiritual?
That's right. Well, there is a campaign, a rhetorical campaign that's been very effective to make it sound like you are, like you said, either a rube or maybe just some kind of nasty bigot. If you confess that you actually believe something that looks like the formal religion of our ancestors. And so people, I think, are really scared to sound dumb if they admit this sort of thing. They, as you say, they kind of wave it away into a more hazy, new age sounding spirituality about some abstract force pulsing through the universe. But, you know, C.S. Lewis pointed out long ago that that's kind of a dodge.
How to Save the West is the book. Spencer Clavin with us for just a couple of more minutes. This final chapter on the regime crisis. You say people take to the streets when they feel their fortunes are being managed with little reference to their own actual needs or desires. Are we close to that point here in the West? And are we toying with these forces that can undo a republic?
Unfortunately, we are, and there's really no way around admitting that, especially if, as I do in the book, you look at the ancient tradition of political philosophy, which is really clear and cogent on kind of what makes regimes fall apart. And Republican regimes, regimes that are republics like ours, fall apart when they are divided into competing classes. Class warfare is what unmakes a republic. And so when you hear people saying things like there's a pandemic of the unvaccinated or white people are inherently racist, then you know that that is the kind of acid that can dissolve the ties that bind us together as fellow citizens. And what the Greeks would have called this is philia, the civic love, the civic friendship that joins us together in an act of nation building. And so what I argue is if we want a chance of turning this thing around, then we've got to reinvest in our neighbors and in our neighborhoods. The closeness that comes from working together toward a common project and living that out in the real world at a human-sized local scale is so crucial for us right now. I mean, I can't promise that what happens, you know, in 10, 20 years is going to be peachy, but I know what our job is, and that's to reinvest in civic love.
Perfect lead into my final question here, because you do talk at the very end about the need for more cohesion, the need to think smaller rather than larger. Tim Carney, in his book Alienated America, talked about these little platoons that we belong to that can help strengthen our communities. It almost seems too simple, Spencer, but can mere love, can human interaction and not digital interaction help fix our problems?
Well, I know that feeling. I know the question, is it really going to be enough just for us to recover love? I mean, I do think that we have reduced love to something that lives in kind of sappy Hallmark cards. And one thing we really need to understand is that, you know, as Dante writes in the last line of his Paradiso, that the love is what moves the stars and the sun, that these things are the whole motive force of the universe is the kind of ferocious love that will not back down from the kind of challenges we're up against. And so in that sense, actually thinking smaller, thinking more simply, especially for people like you and me who aren't running states, we're not running the country, it's a way to do something rather than just to feel despair. And the thing that we are doing, which is carrying forward the tradition of the West, it will never be in vain, no matter what comes. These are traditions that have withstood far worse disasters than any we could possibly dream up or fear. And if we stand for them and enact them in our daily lives, that will be enough.
Spencer Clavin, scholar, writer, and podcaster, editor at the Claremont Institute, and his new book is out now, How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for 5 Modern Crises. Spencer, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Dr. Marty Billman from Hillsdale's Chemistry Department, starting a series we call Drama in Scientific Discoveries. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Al Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
This is Carl Bott
and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
At EDU.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu, click the subscribe button there, and enter your email address. You'll get a message every time there's a new episode of the program. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Marty Billman. She is Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale College. Dr. Billman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, of course. Happy to be here.
Beginning a series today that we call Drama in Scientific Discovery. And this first theme we're talking about is the death of alchemy, which prompts the question, what was alchemy? What do we need to know?
Yeah, so alchemy is sort of like a pseudoscience by modern standards. It existed, I mean, essentially pre-1600s, so like pre-Elizabethan England, kind of like died around the end of the Elizabethan era. It was like one part spiritual and one part scientific. So this is where I use the term pseudoscience. It definitely fell under the category of natural philosophy. They were, I mean, doing their best to utilize, you know, the scientific process, multiple trials of experimentation, see what you get, draw some conclusions. But they also had this sort of like esoteric spiritual aspect as well, where they thought that like the positioning of the planets would lead to success with some reactions, but not others. And essentially they were kind of like grasping at straws in that sense. But what held alchemy together for so long was they essentially had four big goals, and they were lofty goals and goals essentially to help mankind, especially with the cultures like given the day. But of their like four goals, they wanted to first find the elixir of life, right? Like that's the fountain of youth. It's been like one of our goals forever. And it is still a part of like what drives us today, mm-hmm. right? Like we want to find cures for cancer. We want to find, cures for all of these maladies, improve like life expectancy, et cetera. But yeah, like in the alchemic era, they were like, if we could just find this one magical solution, then we would be able to essentially live forever. The second was they were looking for the Philosopher's Stone. I think that's probably the most, like, in hindsight, well-known aspect of alchemy. They wanted to find a couple of other things, universal solvent, all-healing pancreas. But, like, the first two goals were kind of, like, the big drives of alchemy. And they thought that they had, like, some successes. Like, there was enough of, like, a positive feedback to keep them going in this for so long. But there was definitely a point where it kind of, like, fizzled out, you know, and we had to, like, change our course.
So who killed alchemy? What happened?
Yeah, so alchemy was arguably killed by two people. The first is Sir Robert Boyle. He is recognized now as being like one of the quote-unquote fathers of chemistry. And essentially, he is one of the fathers of chemistry because he killed alchemy. he was born to the Earl of Cork, so he was privileged upbringing, very well educated, had a lot of resources at his disposal. After going from school to school, he became a researcher at Oxford. He considered himself a natural philosopher. That was the language used back then. But nowadays, again, we would kind of in hindsight refer to him as like an alchemist chemist. Mm-hmm. He was sort of the in between there. He was very, though, influenced by Francis Bacon, who is arguably attributed with writing the scientific method, you have an idea, you kind of test that idea, you poke and prod at it, but if your results come back negative results, you have to go back and change your thinking. Mm-hmm. So that was something that really influenced Robert Boyle and his approach to alchemy. The second man was Robert Hooke. So both of them were named Robert. But Robert Hooke was born to a poorer family. But this was an era where if you could, get your foot in the door, schooling was everything.
Mm-hmm.
So fortunately, his father, who was a priest, also was a teacher. And so that gave Robert Hooke enough of an education to get into, the next school he went to then get into the next school he went to. And eventually, he ended up a student at Westminster studying mathematics and what they called back in the day mechanisms, but now we would refer to as engineering.
So the two Roberts, mm-hmm. What were their intention? What did they want to do?
Yeah, so they actually wanted, which is, noble regard, and it's what we still do in science today. They wanted to use, the new, burgeoning technologies of the day to really help the world to understand these alchemic tenets and principles, at a deeper level. For example, some of these goals, finding the elixir of life and the philosopher's stone, they just weren't working out. So if we could use the modern technology, of which glass blowing was getting really awesome, we could really have these containers now with great integrity, they wouldn't mm-hmm. shatter as much. Steel was really becoming refined. So if we could use these new technologies to really figure out what the core four elements, earth, wind, water, fire, were, well then maybe we could sort of in this foundational approach, if we know what the elements are, we could use that to the next step of really being able to focus in on how do we make then the philosopher's stone, the elixir of life. To do this, Robert Boyle essentially commissioned Robert Hooke, the young engineer, to make the world's first vacuum pump. Because if we could figure out, again, what the elements were by separating them from each other, and air was the trickiest, because air is omnipresent.
Right.
So if you could make a vacuum pump to get rid of the air, we could then observe the remaining elements inside of the container and see how they behaved. So that was their intention, was to go forward, really figure out what the elements were, as well as since now we have this vacuum pump, we could also use it to test other things mm-hmm. around in the world.
Talking with Dr. Marty Billman, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale, on the death of alchemy. So our Roberts and their vacuum pump and their experiments, what did they find out?
This is probably my favorite part of the story, because they did not find what they expected. So just to lay the scene, we have to put our Elizabethan hats on, We have to go back to the 1600s and essentially forget what we know about fire and air and how they interact. According to the alchemic tenets, much like nowadays, things exist unto their own right, you can't stand in the middle of a desk, you can't phase through a wall, and that's because you can't exist at the same place at the same time as another object. So they thought the same thing about fire and air. So if you took a candle and put it inside of this vacuum pump chamber and pumped out all of the air, what they expected was that the fire would grow.
Mm-hmm.
It would have more space to exist in and therefore would spread itself out. And if we take off our Elizabethan hats, and I ask you the question, what happens when you put a candle inside of a vacuum pump, you would say?
It goes out.
It goes out, which is exactly what they saw, So this was the moment in history where that discovery happened. So that's weird, that's not what we expected at all. And the same sort of phenomenon essentially repeated with a number of different experiments. According to the alchemic tenets, we would expect A,
mm-hmm.
put the thing inside the vacuum pump, and B happened instead, which kind of it leads into this killed alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially in 1661, Robert Boyle published a book on all of these findings entitled it The Skeptical Chemist. Right, and it was spelled very archaic, but like the way that chemist is spelled essentially is in reference to like the alchemists of the day, and said like, listen, if you're an alchemist, pay attention to these results. We have to make sure that we are acknowledging these results, and essentially we are coming to the conclusion that the four elements that we thought were foundational are no longer foundational.
How did all of this work end up killing alchemy altogether?
So this work killed alchemy altogether because, as like previously stated, right, the like fundamental ideology of alchemy was essentially in question.
Mm-hmm.
And so since the four elements couldn't be trusted, as well as like, right, again, to a counterpoint, like it takes a while for big like zeitgeist ideas to shift. And so there were a lot of counterpoints of like, well, what if you retested this when like Mercury was in retrograde, you know? And it's like, no, no matter. We've been studying this. Essentially, when the book was published in 1661, again, The Skeptical Chemist, they reaffirmed we've been looking at this for years, years, right? So we've seen as the planets have been moving and as the tides have been changing and as the phases of the moon have been like going through their cycles, we get the same results, right? So this leads us to two big conclusions. One, the elements are not foundational, so we have to completely change our line of thought from there. As well as, two, it means that the like more esoteric side of alchemy needs to be cut away, right? And essentially that esoteric side of alchemy was like half of the field of alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have to get rid of half of the field of alchemy, then it means, I mean, that alchemy just must be, at its core, incorrect.
Dr. Marty Billman, Assistant Professor of Chemistry here at Hillsdale College, as we discuss the death of alchemy in our Drama in Scientific Discovery series. Dr. Billman, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Yes, thank you so much.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller from Hillsdale's Journalism Department, Spencer Clavin, his new book, How to Save the West, and we heard from Marty Billman from Hillsdale's Chemistry Department. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the program is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Shout out to Redding Rancheria. Appreciate you guys for all your help. With the help that you guys gave us, we were able to stick around, retain some of our employees, and make sure all the customers got what they needed. Thank you, guys.
Hi there. Us here at the Post Office Saloon would like to thank the Redding Rancheria for supporting us and our community through the COVID pandemic.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
We'd like to thank the Reading Rancheria for all their community support, including the bike shop. They do so much for our community, and we're beyond grateful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rancheria. You are the ones we can always count on to help us out in tough times. They're the people that have always been there for us, much more so than anyone else in our community. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.